that's significant in and of itself.
And could you talk about some women of color who fell short and the lessons to be learned from last night's vote? Stacey Abrams, Sherry Beasley. What do you? We have about 30 seconds.
The heartbreaking loss of some of the nation's best candidates, Stacey Abrams, Val Demings in North Carolina, who fell short on her Senate bid, and others, demonstrate that the Democrats who need to invest early and very, very strongly in these excellent candidates in order to protect and build up their capacity to turn out the votes, particularly in a midterm year. The lesson learned is for 24, invest early in the candidates who will inspire the Democratic base, women of color, so that we can be successful next time around.
Well, Amy Allison, I want to thank you for being with us, president and founder of She the People. You can visit democracynow.org to watch our three-hour election night special last night. Democracy Now! Wants to also thank our executive director, Julie Crosby, who worked behind the scenes to make this all happen. We want to thank Renee Feltz and Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Werner, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
Welcome to Never Mind the Ballot. The phone lines are now open. If you'd like to put a question to the candidates, the number to ring is 0532-779-463.
Good morning, everybody. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. This is KBOO Community Radio coming at you from inner southeast Portland, right off of the Burnside Bridge. I'm Paul Roland. I am your host until 9 o'clock. Yes, that was the great, the wonderful Chumbawamba with their cynical take on elections. And whereas I, you know, ideologically, I agree with them. The name of the album is Never Mind the Ballots, Here's the Rest of Your Life. Unfortunately, we do have to pay attention to the ballots. You know, these elections are becoming real, really referenda on the possibility of any kind of future, as far as I'm concerned. You know, whether it's, you know, basic civil rights, like the woman's right to deal with her own body as she sees fit, which, amazingly, this election seemed to be a fairly strong referendum on that right, which is, you know, a little bit of encouragement in that, for sure, in the general dreariness of the prospect of a completely deadlocked, if our system wasn't already deadlocked enough, the possibility of, well, you know, there still is the possibility of the Republicans actually taking control of both the House and the Senate, although it's, you know, it's really touch and go. And of course, with a Democratic president, that would be a total deadlock, because he would, any legislation they would be able to pass would be likely vetoed. And the difficulty of passing any legislation with such a tightly contested both bodies, given that the fact that, you know, this supposed red wave that a lot of people were predicting didn't come to pass, and the Democrats actually held their own in a lot of races. Anyway, I could give you my take on this. I actually held this this spot open without a guest to interview, because I figured people would be wanting to talk about this election. Personally, I thought there'd be a lot of need to kind of commiserate, but you know, it's not as there wasn't as much of a drubbing. Again, you know, I have to always put the proviso that I'm not a huge fan of the party system as it's now constituted. I think the Democrats are generally craven and lack a vision and insight and courage to really, really confront head on the real issues of our time. You know, who knows whether that would actually turn off even more sectors of the electorate if they really talk turkey on the nature of this vicious capitalist system that we live in, on how dire the climate situation really is, on the need to completely relook at our history. I mean, beyond this stupid debate over critical race theory. I mean, it's not stupid. Critical race theory certainly isn't stupid, but the criticism of it are inane and come from the same blind, deaf and dumb, racist, patriarchal insanity that set us on such a disastrous course in this history, in the history of the United States. There's a need to totally relook that, and there's signs that at least the young people are really willing to do that, with the Black Lives Matter protests, with the, you know, the challenge to the icons of, you know, the representation of the past in this country, the Confederate statues, the statues of Columbus, the whole glorification of conquest and all that. But anyway, so yeah, 503-231-8187, we can get right to it. I've got a few things, more specific things I want to talk about. Of course, there are some local races that are really important. It looks really possible that Joanne Hardesty, our courageous city commissioner, might well not make it, to a newcomer, Rene Gonzalez, a businessman who, in my view, does represent the kind of chamber of commerce business interests. So that's a doesn't look so good for those people who do support Joanne Hardesty. I think I can say that now, although, yeah, because all the ballots are in. I can't openly support anybody before the election. Gosh, I hope I have that right. Anyway, Then there's some interesting statewide ballot measures. There's the firearms ballot measure, which imposes much more stringent regulations on the ability to, on what you have to do to register to buy a firearm and the types of firearms you can buy. That looks like it's going to pass, although it's kind of touch and go. The fact that taking the language of forced servitude, slavery and forced servitude out of the state constitution in Oregon actually didn't pass by flying colors. There's 600,000 or 700,000 Oregonians voted to keep that in. What's up with that? I guess maybe people are more educated about the nature of the prison industrial complex than we give them credit for, and they would like to have people engage in slave labor in the prisons. Is that what's up? Yeah, I'd like to hear your take. What are your biggest takeaways from this election? Are you one who still thinks that these elections are basically a sham and really, you know, the only thing that is possible to make real social change is the citizenry rising up, which doesn't seem to show much signs in any big sense. In fact, perhaps we're even closer to the Civil War that a lot of people have been talking about for months, years now, especially since January 6th of last year. But, you know, since Trump came into office, since the Patriot Prayer and the Proud Boys all get together and started creating havoc in the streets and found their match in the Antifa movement. Are we closer to a civil war? Is that what a totally deadlocked political system is going to lead to? A lot of open questions. Then there's the 27? I can't keep track. The Conference of Parties in Egypt, of all places. The climate change negotiations that have been going on and on. And not really coming to the nub of the matter, kind of kicking it down the road, and we can't kick it down the road anymore. I've got an article kind of caught my eye here, Climate Activism on the Brink of Nuclear War, from about a week ago on Counterpunch by Eve Ottenberg. I'll just start reading that until people get the... I don't know, maybe get their thoughts clarified or take a few more sips of coffee or whatever it is and call into 503-231-8187. I'm flying solo, so I'd like to engage you in a conversation. So she starts out saying, one lesson the disastrous NATO-Russia war in Ukraine has taught us is that an attempt to decrease the climate catastrophe by kicking the oil, gas, and coal habit must be carefully planned. A perfect recipe for turning popular opinion anti-green is to slam the brakes on fossil fuels with no substitute ready, as has happened in Europe due to its imbecilic sanctions on Russian energy. Those sanctions backfired, causing fuel prices to spike. Russia got rich, Europe is going broke, and any popular support for ditching oil and gas evaporated. Good work, Biden and bird-brain bureaucrats. The West shot itself in the head and set back possibly a decade the cause of transitioning off fossil fuels. But that transition must come, and sooner than a decade. The climate catastrophe is here, already scarifyingly evident in fires, killer heat waves, massive droughts, floods, storms. And that's just the beginning. Temperatures of 120 degrees Fahrenheit in British Columbia has occurred in the summer of 2021 are not normal. Floods in Pakistan that submerge a third of the country are not normal. 100 degrees in the Russian Arctic town of Verkhoyansk on June 20, 2020 is not normal. Mega droughts across the western U.S., Europe, Africa, and southern China are not normal. Polar ice melting for good is not normal. And those are only a few of the symptoms we experience right now, hints of a dark, ferociously difficult human future. Earth has a fever, and the richest countries caused it by burning too much oil, coal, and gas. That fever will not die down. It will only go up unless humanity takes swift, though orderly, thought-out, rational countermeasures. But you can't reach zero or even net zero carbon emissions by blowing up gas pipelines. That just makes people frantic as they face astronomical fuel prices and freezing winters with no heat. Then they do things like reviving the use of coal, chopping down forests to burn another dirty source of energy, wood, and deciding nuclear power might save them. It won't, as has happened in energy-starved Europe. To make matters worse, the Nord Stream explosion caper released 300,000 metric tons of methane into the atmosphere, the equivalent of the annual emissions of 1 million cars and the largest ever discharge of methane. This is a climate crime because methane is a greenhouse gas 80 times more potent than carbon. Imperial gangsters who blow up pipelines won't bring the green revolution. Wind and solar, many times more than we have already, just might. But that means investment in a legal framework that prohibits idiocies like Biden's tariffs on Chinese solar tech, now apparently and thankfully waived. And it continues. It's a long article, worth a read. That's again, Climate Activism on the Brink of Nuclear War by Eve Ottenberg. Yeah, it's hard to think about these big questions. I tend to obsessively focus on them here because I just don't see it happening enough, you know, on a large enough scale. You know, everybody's still trapped in our, you know, busy, individual, harried, frantic, complicated lives, trapped in the technosphere and unable to extricate ourselves and unable to, you know, get off the merry-go-round of fossil fuel use. And where is it going to come from? I don't know. I really don't. But it's certainly not going to come from the Republicans, and it's certainly not going to come from the corporate Democrats. Any sign that, you know, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which, you know, there is some reason for enthusiasm for them showing up more and more on the scene over the last 5 to 10 years. But that retraction of the rather basic, simple letter on Ukraine, requesting negotiations, the withdrawal, to me signaled, yeah, I guess they thought, you know, I don't know what they thought. They thought it was going to hurt him in the elections? Maybe. I don't know. What do you think? Another article we got, which actually is proven not to be accurate, Democrats burn it all down, just came out a couple days ago, I think, maybe even yesterday, by Arun Gupta. No, actually it came out a little further back than that, 3 days ago. I usually really appreciate what Arun has to say, but he focuses on the Ukraine war as well, and he believed that because of the Ukraine war, there was going to be a complete rout of the Democrats. But I think his analysis is worth looking at. I think people just don't really want to look. Most people really don't want to look hard at the Ukraine war. You know, much as a few of us on the airwaves, very few of us, focus a lot on that because we see it both as a symptom of the continuing imperial power games, including by the United States and NATO. You know, I don't want to let Putin off the hook, but you know, a lot of people just don't want to look at the role of the United States and NATO. Just don't. I don't know. It's a don't want to look at the emperors having no clothes or what it is. So anyway, let me just read some of this again. I'm Paul Rowland. I'm hosting this show, Wednesday Talk Radio. Love to engage you in conversation about what this day means, what the results mean. Of course, it's not all in, so maybe people are reluctant to pronounce when we really don't know. We don't even know if the Republicans are necessarily going to take control of the House. It looks like it. We certainly don't know who's going to, You know, are we going to end up with another 50-50 tie? It looks like Warnock and Herschel Walker are going to be faced into a runoff in Georgia. It looks like Arizona might well go Democrat. Fetterman won in Pennsylvania. That was something of a surprise to a lot of people. But yeah, we're heading towards probably even worse gridlock than we had before. Well, let me just give you a little bit of Arun Gupta's take. The Democrats are burning it all down. They're going to lose the midterms because of the Ukraine war. A red wave of extremists will sweep into office because of the Ukraine war. Let me just say that it looks like a lot of those extremists actually are facing a lot tougher battle than was expected. Anyway, insurrectionists will have an inside path to a coup in 2024 because of the Ukraine war. Biden is doubling down on fossil fuels, ensuring climate catastrophe because of the Ukraine war. The far right is gaining power across Europe because of the Ukraine war. A food crisis has put tens of millions on the brink of starvation because of the Ukraine war. It didn't have to be this way. Let me explain. Every single poll shows most voters are angry about record inflation, a turbulent economy, and sky-high gas prices. But it's even simpler than that. It turns out that there's a strong correlation between gas prices and voter approval of Biden and the Democrats. National average prices peaked at over $5 a gallon over the summer. Images of a $7 a gallon gas prices are a powerful meme and evidence to voters that their earnings are being burned up by $100 tank refills. Soaring gas and crude oil prices rip through global supply arteries already damaged by the pandemic. Anyway, he says that basically this is all because of the war in Ukraine, which certainly the facts are there. The rise in gas prices started after the Ukraine war. Not exclusively, but, you know, and it may seem ironic to anyone who argues so strenuously as I do, and generally Arun Gupta, that, you know, the climate catastrophe has to be dealt with. We have to take it way more seriously on a policy level than policymakers across the globe are willing to do. Maybe seem ironic that talking so much about gas prices, but as the, you know, as the politics, the article I read before, I think really wisely points out that kicking the oil, gas, and coal habit must be carefully planned. The problem with that is capitalism doesn't engage in that kind of planning. It only looks at short-term profits. So we're caught in this serious dilemma. Let me just continue here. In other words, workers suffered more last spring than during the peak of the Great Recession. Well, that's it. I got to read the previous paragraph. By June, gas prices had shot up 60% from a year earlier, and food and household goods leaped 10%. As a result, the real wages of most workers plunged in the second quarter of 2022, with a median drop of 8.6%. The Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas calls the situation the most severe faced by employed workers over the past 25 years. In other words, workers suffered more last spring than during the peak of the Great Recession. They were going to lash out at whoever was in power, but they have every reason to be pissed at Biden because their economic suffering is directly related to the Ukraine war. While Washington has instigated conflict with Russia for decades, particularly by expanding NATO, it was a choice by Putin to launch an illegal invasion of Ukraine that's devolved into a brutal slugfest with widespread war crimes by Russian forces. Similarly, it was a choice by Biden to impose the harshest economic sanctions ever levied against a country in the post-World War II era. And it goes on. Again, this is a long article, well worth your read. You actually can only get it on Counterpunch Plus, so you have to be a contributor of a certain kind to get it, so I apologize for that. I could probably copy it and send it to you if you really wanted to. Or I could just continue to read, but I'd really like to engage with you. We're already at 8:23, heading into the second half hour of the show, 503-231-8187. I was hoping to get your impressions of what the elections meant. Maybe you were hoping I would have some hotshot guest to talk about that with me. And you could just sit back and listen. That could be. That's your right. But since we do have open phone lines and I'm here all by myself, I'd love to hear what you got to say. Give me a call, 503-231-8187. Otherwise, I'll just keep giving you my opinion. See, it looks like Tina Kotek is kind of neck and neck with Christine Drazen. And looks like Betsy did her job of probably, although it's hard to say whether she actually drew off as many votes from the Republican as from the Democrat, but since it's been so long since we've had so long, I don't know, how long has it been, 15, 20 years since we've had a Republican governor, that it was somewhat surprising to see Christine Drazen do so well in the polls, and now it's, I think, a 1% margin dividing them. I don't know, do any of these things matter to you? Well, it looks like we got one caller coming up. As soon as we get them on the line, we will bring them up. Anyway, so 503-231-8187. As I said, looks like we do have one caller. It's Greg, go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay, let me turn down the radio here.
Okay.
So, yes, I'm not sure who you were reading about or from when you were going through everything with the war in Ukraine, but it seriously is. You understand they have the gas prices jacked here, a complete fabrication that they're working, shutting down refineries in California when we don't get any gas from California here in Portland. And they jacked it like 90 cents this time, and it ain't going down, or at least the good stations aren't, but...
So you're saying that the premise that the Ukraine war has so much to do with rising gas prices might be somewhat exaggerated because the oil companies are making massive profits and they don't really need to raise the prices so much?
They are war gouging, they're price gouging.
That's for sure.
Because of the war. And the idea that somehow the war has something to do with supply. Remember, the Saudis did not like the idea that what we're doing to Russia, so they limited supply. But we have all the supply we need right here. We're a fossil fuel exporter, but we don't get any gas here in Portland from these California refineries that they're talking about. They have a complete monopoly on the prices here on the West Coast. This is also across the country. It's just stronger out west here, and it's been this way for a number of years. They need to do antitrust against the distributors and or the companies that are doing this price gouging.
Which brings us back to the elections, is that if that's ever going to happen within the political system we have, the only chance is if not only do the Democrats soundly retake control of both houses, but the progressive Democrats actually gain more power within the Democratic Party. At least that's the only thing I can see that would do it.
We need to get the Democrats to stop, and I just call them, you know, Republicans and Democrats the same, just two wings of the same business party. We need to get them to stop being the warmongers. They could have done a lot better if they could have negotiated with Russia. You know, the news here about, you know, it's just so bad with Ukraine. They just keep on with the same crap, and nobody seems to notice. So disappointed in people that are our age, Paul, that should remember Iraq. And yes, we're not sending troops over there, but it's, you know, obvious to the rest of the planet that this is a proxy war, but that word can't be spoken here. So they were.
It is and it isn't. I'm starting to more and more want to be a little more nuanced, because it's true that Ukraine it's kind of simple and easy to see them as heroic defenders of their homeland and not look at the wider geopolitical picture. But there is an aspect to that has to be taken into account. You know, so it is a proxy war, but it's also war being fought by Ukrainians who are actually dying, and we're not against, you know, an aggressor. So
yes, they're blonde and blue-eyed. You will notice that there's no such buildup about the Iraqi people or the Afghani people or any of dozens of places around the world we're currently killing people with our military machine. But
true enough,
Europe, It is in Europe, but importantly, they look just like us. And I think that this is the thing that has bamboozled all the lefties that should understand what we're doing over there. But hey, the coverage is horrible. It's just horrible, you know? Putin is over there fighting for his naval base. He's threatening, has threatened here in the last week that, you know, if the Ukrainians don't submit, he's going to level Odessa, because Odessa can shell that naval base. So he's fighting for the water supply for Crimea, plus this little deal about the bridge that nobody knew existed. I didn't. You didn't. I'm sure very few Americans knew it existed. But he's getting his land bridge, his land corridor, for a supply to that all-important warm water naval base called Sevastopol. This is why he invaded. Nothing else. That's it. And that's completely unreported. So nobody knows anything because they won't talk about what the problem is and what Putin wants. So here recently we had a short shutdown of the grain ships that were coming out with the agreement. They have the little channel that they can go through. Well, our friends, the Ukrainians, were shelling some ships from that grain corridor. So the Russians shut it down, completely unreported here, of course, and they went into secret negotiations, and the Ukrainians were told they can't do that. So all this stuff goes completely unreported. And what I'm talking about is they're shelling ships that are close to the all-important warm water port. Completely unreported here.
Well, any other takeaways from the election?
I was a little bit shocked by this Measure 111 because I hadn't heard one word about it. This is the affordable health care.
Oh, yeah.
I just looked at the voters' pamphlet, hadn't heard a word about it, didn't know it existed. And they had read the first half dozen people that were for it. Not a word about who was going to pay for this. So it appears as though that somebody put this on the ballot to further hollow out the public school system.
I guess that's one take. I mean,
it's not one take. There's nothing in there for funding.
Yeah, but to say that's their intention of hollowing out the public education system.
Look at what the statement is and what it does. It says that they will take money from other public things like the public schools to pay for this affordable health care. It's a scam. So apparently,
let's see what
there's enough people apparently who will look through, because everybody wants access to affordable health care, right? Again, haven't heard a word about this anywhere.
Well, let's see what other people have to say about that, because you know what I see it as more is the same old competing for the artificially small shares of the pie, when you know really the real problem is this massive overspending on you name it, especially the military budget, but any number of other things we could talk about if we really look at actually a reasonable use of collective resources. The idea that we have collective resources, of course, is anathema, but a reasonable use of the resources that go to mostly to millionaires and billionaires and the Pentagon and the massive corporations who suck off all the wealth, and everybody else is fighting for the crumbs. And so you have things like this. To see that as an actual conscious strategy to gut the public education system seems to me a stretch, but I don't know. I haven't really given it enough thought, so I'd like to hear what other people have to say.
I haven't looked at it closely at all.
Okay.
I didn't trust what I read. Those first six things, it just looked like some sort of a joke.
All right. Well, thanks for calling. Always good to hear from you, Greg. 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187 is the number to call in. So he asked where I was reading from. Again, I was reading from an article on Counterpunch, regular Counterpunch. Climate Activism on the Brink of Nuclear War by Eve Ottenberg, talking about how let me just reread this first paragraph. I think we really need to clarify our understanding of geopolitics. I really think there's a serious resistance, that it's a natural resistance because we tend to think about things that are closer to us. But, I think we are subject to sort of general, you know, whether you want to call it propaganda or just the sort of ideological limits of, you know, our nation state slash capitalist system that don't really, you know, there isn't the level of analysis of geopolitics by the major media is mediocre at best, I think. And so it's back to us. Like my guest last week of the Foreign Policy Alliance was talking about the need for civic activism, that we need to take back since foreign affairs is run by the weapons and manufacturers and fossil fuel companies, etc., we need to somehow take it back, because that's what's distorting the entire global social system, economic system. It's the militarization and the extremes of capitalism. So how, if we're ever going to resolve anything, we have to deal with these things ourselves. So here, let me just reread this. Looks like we got another caller. I just want to reread this first paragraph by this article. One lesson the disastrous NATO-Russia war in Ukraine has taught us is that an attempt to decrease the climate catastrophe by kicking the oil, gas, and coal habit must be carefully planned. A perfect recipe for turning popular opinion anti-green is to slam the brakes on fossil fuels with no substitute ready, as has happened to Europe due to its imbecilic sanctions on Russian energy. Those sanctions backfired, causing fuel prices to spike. Russia got rich, Europe is going broke, and any popular support for ditching oil and gas evaporated. Good work, Biden and bird brain bureaucrats. Okay, so that's one theme. The elections, of course, which we're getting the many, if not all, of the results from. Looks like we got Mark coming up next. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Paul. You know, Biden has actually condemned the 6 or 8 oil companies that have earned $100 billion over the last 200 days.
He's condemned them, but he hasn't eliminated their subsidies.
Right. I'm very sorry. I'm very sad about the terrible communication, the terrible media system that the corporate world has given us. We're really left without any information. As your first caller, Greg, said, Europe, it's in Germany in particular, seem to be sacrificed because of the exorbitant energy costs. They're facing a winter of freezing. What we need, I think, is a Marshall Plan for journalism that's organized by non-governmental foundations, maybe like KABU.
Uh-huh. Well, I know you've brought this subject up in the past, and it's an interesting one.
I'm very distressed by the fact that our economy, which is an economy of indebtedness and enrichment, is glossed over, is not really understood. You know, we have a speculative economy. There's a Republican, Jerome Powell, in charge of the Federal Reserve, who has been raising the interest rates, leading to lower investment and higher unemployment. I don't think this is really known by most people.
Well, let's get back to the subject of the journalism. I think relatively small as a community radio station with a very limited budget and small staff, and we have we're lucky we have a strong signal due to our privileged position on a transmission tower in the West Hills, and we have two translators that go out to the gorge and the Corvallis Philomath area, which is good, but compared to Clear Channel and Fox News and all that, we're very limited.
Right.
So but we are part as an affiliate of the Pacifica Foundation. The Pacifica, at one point, I'm talking about like trying to do things from the ground up as opposed to the top down, because you have to really look at this. What are our real capabilities? And so, you know, Pacifica's had its problems. I think its potential was undermined for various reasons. You know, we had the Pacifica Nightly News, which was a really great thing as a kind of counterpoint, you know, to both the corporate media and NPR. You know, then so you got that, which is sort of, you know, as you know, the Pacifica stations have hung on despite great problems and controversies, conflicts, etc.
Well,
you've got NPR, which is, you know, very rather tepid. It doesn't have the kind of incisive analysis that we would like, especially on the Ukraine war and you know, imperial conflicts, imperial aims, the, you know, global military machine. And then you've got, you know, you had Air America, which was an attempt to have a liberal counterpoint to, again, the you know, the national reach of people like, I can't even remember his name now. He's been dead for a while. The blowhard, the right-wing blowhard. I can't, his name just doesn't come to me. Anyway, hold on. Let me just finish this thought. It's going to wrap up. They floundered, I guess, I think because of lack of commitment by the major funders. You know, it takes a lot of money. And maybe the capitalist system won't support something that's actually somewhat of a critic, because there were critics of capitalism on Air America. Maybe it's just against, it just can't happen under capitalism. Maybe that's the problem.
Capitalism cannot survive unless it radically changes. Now, the tax havens should be dissolved. The tax avoidance industry should be attacked. The stock buybacks should be abolished. The mini second trade.
Right. We can say all these things. But what are the real potentialities of those of us who are talking and listening to this right now? Well, you know, we can say this should happen, that should happen. It's all very well and good, but how do you actually build power? How do you actually build capacity? And I'm talking about, how do you do that? And all I know is what things that I'm involved in, things that I've seen. And so that's all I know.
KPFA and KBOO are doing great work as a counter power to the right-wing takeover.
Right, but we're just such small potatoes, is what I'm saying. And what I was saying was that things like Air America, which was an attempt to have something like the reach, and which I thought was really good. I thought there were some really good hosts on there. I really enjoyed that. You know, that even Tom Hartman was there for a while, and I forget, there was one woman who I really, really liked, was one of the most radical ones. It's been so long. But yeah, so we don't really have CNN, is kind of a counterweight to Fox News, but I don't know if you've been watching, I don't know if anybody's there has been watching the series on the Murdoch family and their power, and how the head of the Murdoch clan rose to power in Australia and then went to England and then came to the United States. And, you know, you can do, you know, that's permissible. That's possible within the capitalist system.
Right. Now, Rainer Mausfeld, who's a professor in Germany and who recommended the website deepl.com, wrote an essay titled, We Face a Radical Counter-Enlightenment. Now, I think this is very true. I think we need to do whatever we can to link the Republicans to this right-wing fascist abolition of democracy.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right. I don't know. I just get a little frustrated by saying, you know, we need to do this, we need to do that, we can do... It's, you know, how do we actually build the power? Is it even possible? I don't know. That's what I'm indicating. You know, the capitalist system seems to be really capable of co-opting, short-circuiting, derailing, or just marginalizing. You know, I think KBOO is pretty marginalized. I think Pacifica is pretty marginalized. I think, you know, the vast number of people who listen to Fox News, and even the people who listen to, you know, CNN aren't really getting, as I said, the kind of incisive analysis. You know, even here, you know, we used to have the Alliance newspaper. I thought used to be a really, you know, again, a very marginal voice, but a very powerful, small presence in the community that I think a lot of, you know, that I think that one of the advantage, one of the things that places like Democracy Now!, Pacifica, KBOO do, is the people who are more open-minded, more, you know, more less under the sway of the dominant narrative, who work for places like NPR or wherever, are able to actually listen to and get story ideas. I think that's one thing, and that's what the Alliance was really useful for. And we don't really, you know, print has gone out of fashion. We don't, you know, it's just hard to get everything so siloed. Everybody's, you know, going on the algorithms. It's a pretty dismal situation. But let's hear what Robbie has to say about it. And I think we got another caller after that. Go ahead, Robbie.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to bring up the journalism has changed drastically, but not by that much, considering the propaganda. There's really a fascinating interview with a CIA, an ex-CIA person, who basically goes into it. And I don't know what you feel about Jimmy Dore, but Jimmy Dore played this the other day about how they were able to create the Vietnam War and the support behind it. And it's almost identical to Ukraine today, but basically what they can do, and I tell people this, you know, I hope people can, when we're reading the CNN, NPR, OPB News, which is all bought and paid for by corporations now, including Democracy Now!, which I find problematic, there's what they'll say is U.S. officials have said. And all that means, like, you'll see all the war stories about Ukraine, you'll see U.S. officials and intelligence services say. And this is basically the beginning of all the propaganda that we're being fed. All of these war stories, all of this comes from these U.S. officials, which is just CIA talking points coming to the news, which is why everybody and their brother and mother said that Putin is a bully and it was an unprovoked attack, because that's what they lambasted into us for the last, you know, 7 or 8 months now, I guess, 10 months now. And those are the talking points that they get through into people's heads, completely ignoring the last, you know, 8 years of the conflict there, and coming to the idea that somehow this was just a completely unprovoked and Putin's a bully. Those are the talking points that they spray through. But when you're reading news articles, you'll see, follow the sources. It will say U.S. officials. And anytime it says that, this wonderful interview that was back post-Vietnam, like right afterwards, the CIA guy goes into it. He's like, this is just how they create the narrative that they want the people to believe, which is why everybody's up in arms about Russia's unprovoked attack on Ukraine, which actually went back 8 years, you know, and you know, was a lot more, you know, it's a lot more nuanced than just this crazy, just randomly they try to do it, and Ukraine's fighting for their survival now against a random aggressor, and Putin's losing, and I don't know, he was supposed to take over all of Ukraine, but if you look at what he's actually done, I don't think we can believe any of the news reports about what they're saying, because it is a war. The fog of war creates this muddied waters, if you will.
That's an interesting metaphor. The fog of war creates the muddy waters. Anyway, you know, I agree with your points generally. You are probably, you know, as you let me know often, you're probably more way more tuned in to a lot of these alternative sources and really looking into this deeper than I am, which I guess I must confess that I often feel that I'm falling down on the job as a talk show host, as I probably don't dig as deep into stuff as I should. And I could give you, you know, I could give you all my personal reasons for, you know, why that is, but whatever, that would be really boring. But it's an indication though of how difficult it is. You know, I mean, I don't think we acknowledge enough how much sort of our minds and spirits are under the onslaught of the culture we live in, you know, and how much of a struggle it is to attain the kind of clarity that you seem to have, that you certainly feel you have, and I in what you say, I hear a coherence and a clarity that's admirable. I think we just don't, you know, we don't have the support. You know, it's, if you don't have like a milieu around you that's like encouraging you, or you're like really talking stuff out with people, it's hard to do it by yourself. It really is. And I don't think we acknowledge that enough.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. Yeah, and thank you very much. I appreciate always the time and the conversations. I definitely think that this is the key to trying to fix and you know, salvage that. I'll just say, to end my point, it's like, yeah, look at Nord Stream 2. All of a sudden, nobody cares about it, and the media is sweeping it under the rug. And it's like, oh, well, you know, which side do you think was correct in their analysis of who did it, Russia
well,
that,
that's
or
quite,
NATO?
That is quite a striking thing. I mean, it looked at in and of itself, it's a big deal. I mean, it's a huge story, but the fact that it doesn't seem to be getting the kind of attention that it would seem to deserve, as an event, as a world historical event, as a news event, does seem to point in the direction that you're pointing to.
Yeah, I guess just one last point. I guess if there is one thing, it's like, I don't understand why we're so quick to discredit anything Russia has to say, like the allegations against the fact that Britain blew up the pipeline or that there was supposed, you know, all this stuff. But it's just so weird that it's like, in my mind, it's like, okay, I'm critical of both, you know, authoritarian regimes, the one that I'm currently living under and the one in Russia. But it's just so weird watching people who say they're critical of America just immediately say that whatever Russia says isn't true. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that we need to kind of like observe a little bit more, because of, you know, look at Nord Stream 2. You know, this is so obvious to the people who were, you know, paying attention to it, because there were, you know, signs, there was news articles saying that we were going to do it. You know, Biden himself said he was going to make sure it was ended and it won't happen. And then here we are. Oh, did Russia do it? That's like the most absurd thing that everybody believed.
All right. Well, always good to hear from you. We got a couple more callers, and we only got less than 10 minutes to go. Let's hear what everybody always calls at the end of the show. I was begging you to call at the beginning of the show, and you didn't do it. And now you're just going to have to get a little less time. That's all right. I really appreciate your calling, Pete. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for having me on here. You were talking about, you know, building solidarity, and like, you mentioned the word clarity, and with all this stuff, and we're talking about propaganda, I just got to say, we just got to put down the phones. Just less phones will make all this better, I think. I mean, it's the ultimate, you know, device for propagandizing this entire population, and it's a simple act to just put it away, you know, and it forces you can be forced to have, you know, face-to-face connections with your fellow people, and that's the only way that anything useful is going to come out of movements nowadays. I don't think the phone just is not a thing.
Well, you know,
to build real connections,
people said that about, you know, many previous technologies, and we're right, you know, at the time. That's the nature of technology. In, you know, modern technology, is that it just gets more and more and more and more sophisticated and invasive and personalized. And then, you know, this is just the culmination. And, you know, what comes next, you could almost, I guess, if people are, there's probably people who are predicting, you know, people could really see the development of the current cell phone, which, you know, incorporates so many different previous technologies into it. But I guess my point is that, you know, the development of advertising, the development of television, the development of, you know, many different technologies that have all kind of come together. It's all a system that works together. So I guess pointing at just one of the technologies, I think, is a little oversimplified personally, but I get your point. I think, you know, I've resisted getting a smartphone. I've still got a flip phone. They made me go up to 4G and get a slightly bigger one, you know, and I realize this might sort of a pathetic, you know, personal gesture, kind of spitting in the wind. But, you know, I don't like those things. I don't like to be so hooked in. So I certainly hear what you're saying. I don't know if, you know, I don't know if there is one, you know, solution, you know, like you say. I sort of resist that, but I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, no, definitely not one solution. Just, I think if we all just spend less time staring into the propaganda rectangle, you know.
Right on.
We can be better. But
all right, well, yeah, thanks for that input. We got Harry and then maybe one other, but we only have a few minutes left. Go ahead, Harry. Oh, we lost Harry, perhaps. Looks like maybe we had one more. I think my board operator, Ty, is talking to them at the moment.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Harry.
Oh, that is Harry. Good to hear from you, Harry.
Okay, thank you for taking my call. One of the biggest things about this the election this year in Oregon, as everyone forgets, is Multnomah County. Last year they passed the law that the Multnomah County chair can only be on it for 8 years. The last 27 years, we've been under the control of the Kafori family, and the mother, and lately the daughter. And it's going to be up to the people of Multnomah County to ask the new commissioners and the chair to maybe do an audit of Multnomah County since we were under control of the Kafori family. What did the Kafori family do? Well, one is, everyone remembers, was Wapato. We have a prison already set up. We need prison beds. And what the Kaforis did was, first, they got rid of the parole and probation system. There is no parole officers in Multnomah County anymore. Second is, there's like 60-bed pots at the Inverness Jail that are empty. That's 180 beds.
Now, I think you've talked about the Kafuris before. It seems to be one of your, a beta noir of yours, so to speak. Unfortunately, we're so close to the end, and I don't know nearly as much about it as you do that I can't give you any reasonable feedback, and I'm not sure where that conversation would go at the point, but so we do have a new chair. What do you think of the new chair, Multnomah Commissioner Chair?
It's still on the election. The last time I checked, it's still neck and neck, so I heard.
No, I don't think so. I think there's a clear winner. But anyway.
Oh, there is. Okay, good, good. Well, I'll have to check the news on that. It's just that the it's just something we have to talk about is they've cut a lot of costs and stuff like that. That's why we have a crime problem, is because they just give them a ticket and they let them go.
Well, I don't know about that. I think we have a crime problem because we have a vicious dog-eat-dog economic system that doesn't encourage sharing and cooperation and basically allows a relatively small percentage of the population to get away with the large share of the loot, and everybody else is kind of caught fighting for it. And, you know, we got this speculative economy in housing where, you know, the rents are allowed to go up, and, you know, landlords have all this power. And we need to socialize the system, and that's the only way out, I think. And so, on a policy level, I don't know. It's like I say, I don't know as much as you do about it. And you seem to be a lot more passionate than I do. And we are really close to the top of the hour.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call.
All right. I don't never know what to do with stuff like that. Again, you know, I'm an abysmal failure in general as a talk show host, in that you kind of need to know a lot about a lot of different things, or pretend you do. And maybe I do pretend that I do a fair amount. But anyway, I tend to look at the bigger picture. I think a lot of these, you know, policy questions, you know, houselessness is a huge, huge issue now. You know, so many people are all up in arms. But, you know, nobody really wants to look at the root cause of why there's people who are forced to live outside in the streets in tarps, you know. It's the economy, stupid. And we just don't want to look at it. I mean, you know, capitalism is still a taboo word, you know. I try to talk a little bit about it here. I think I never hear anyone on NPR talking about capitalism. Never, 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 ever. CNN, never, 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 never. Why is that? It's really odd. Have you ever thought about that? Well, I'll just leave you with that thought. We are at the top of the hour. I don't know if Fight the Empire is next, but something good is coming up here on KBOO. Thanks for listening. Support KBOO. Go to kbo.fm and give us some of your love financially. All right. Bye, everybody.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy